From NPR News, this is News at Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. They've been fighting for it for a long time, and now Congress has finally beaten the veto. On a 79-14 vote Thursday night, the Senate joined an earlier vote this week by the House and successfully gave Congress its first veto override during the Bush administration. At stake, a $23 billion water resources bill and an opportunity for some flexing by the democratically controlled Congress. Here's California Senator Barbara Boxer.
I think that there's much made of the size of this bill by the president, but he somehow has disassociated himself from the amounts he's spending overseas. We know now, given President Musharraf $11 billion, so, you know, let's just say it's time for America. And I think that this veto override is a strong statement from both sides of the aisle that it is time for our country. We cannot overlook the needs of our country. We are a generous and decent and good people. Our people need help as well.
With more spending bills pending, especially around war costs, the veto comes at an important time. But how important? Well, that's the topic number one on today's Reporters Roundtable. Joining us are Kevin Merida, associate editor of The Washington Post, also the editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Also with us, Newsday columnist Cheryl McClain, and joining me in studio, Erin Aubrey Kaplan. She is contributing editor at the LA Times op-ed section. Hello, everybody.
Hey,
how
Tony?
Are you? Hey, Tony.
Kevin, let's go right into the Beltway with you on this veto. The question that I have, does one override really open the door for others to come? I would think that it would depend.
Well, it is going to depend, but you see that, you know, basically this divide between the Congress and the White House over the use of spending is really coming to a head. You know, this is it's kind of on now. And, you know, especially the differences between Congress and the White House over domestic programs and war spending. And I think that's kind of the backdrop of the whole thing. You know, the president's asked for, you know, an additional $200 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yet, you know, he's vetoed a children's health insurance bill, you know, twice stem cell research bills. And I think that you're seeing a lot of pushback, and of course, with Democrats controlling the Congress, you can have that pushback.
That was going to be my question to you, Cheryl. Why this particular bill is the one that was able to be overwritten?
I think there's several reasons, and it's McCarthy. It's not McClain, Tony.
It is? I'm sorry.
I've been called a lot of things.
Okay.
Worse than that. But I think it's about three things. I think it's certainly about Katrina. And what that told us about the importance of maintaining our shorelines and our infrastructure, and the fact that a large amount of federal money has gone to Louisiana to help rebuild the levee there. And other states want to get, you know, have their own things that need to be done, and they want to get money for that. I think, you know, this bill is also for a lot of projects that members of Congress can bring to their own states and take credit for. And that's really important. And I also think, as Barbara Boxer said, it's probably, in a sense, a backlash against all the war spending. You know, we've been spending, you know, billions, I don't know if it's a trillion yet, you know, in Iraq. And Bush is saying, you know, he can't do the water bill because it's going to cost too much. And people are saying, look, we've got things here that need to be taken care of.
All right, let's move on to topic number two. The writer's strike, which is moving on, began this week. The Writers Guild of America. NPR recently interviewed Mara Brock Akil, who was a showrunner for both The Game television show as well as Girlfriends, about why she was striking.
A union has to stick together. It doesn't work any other way. I think also America's, this is not just our fight, this is America's fight. I mean, our jobs are going overseas. They think that we are easily replaced. The TV shows could be written by anybody, and it's not true.
Here's my question for you, Erin Aubrey Kaplan, since we're here in Hollywood and we seem to...
Unfortunately.
Yeah, we're closest to this. One of the issues about the strike, if you go back 20 years to the previous Writers Guild strike, is that it opens up a door for some new kinds of programming. Do you see that happening this time?
New kinds of programming? You mean...
Well, you know, reality TV sort of came out the first time. Forgot about that.
God, nothing is a worse prospect than reruns of reality TV. Then it becomes not reality, but a rerun.
That's true.
Well, I think... It remains to be seen how the networks will have to scramble. It's been a long time since a strike, but you know, the issue at stake, which is, you know, new media, which is, you know, the writers' cut of revenue from that, is a very important one, and it's kind of a line in the sand that will probably be there for a while, so it won't be a short strike, and so. And actually, this will have implications for SAG, because that contract is coming as well, the Screen Actors Guild.
And the producers, too, right?
I believe so.
Yeah,
so this is I agree with the comment that we heard from one of the strikers. This will not be a quickly resolved issue. But
I want to know, in terms of you, Cheryl, as well as Kevin, is this playing as an issue in your communities and in your publications? Cheryl, you first, and then you, Kevin.
Well, there's some coverage here, but I think, you know, the issues for the writers tend to be somewhat different between the East Coast and the West Coast. You know, on the West Coast, you really got the TV production and the big movie production and the people who are making, the writers who are making a lot of money. I mean, on the East Coast, I think you tend to have writers who write more for the theater, make less money. So the stakes are probably somewhat lower.
Kevin.
Well, we had a front page story about it and a very entertaining one. I think there's a lot of interest here because there's a great nexus between, you know, politics and government and Hollywood. And so there's often many of the politicians watch the Lenos and the Conans and the Lettermans. They appear on them and they get skewered those shows are particularly affected, as Jay Leno has said himself, that he's not funny without those writers. And so they went into reruns. And so I think that there is interest in following it here.
One more show business topic we'd like to hit in the time that we have with the Reporters Roundtable today, and it's this. It's Jacko, as the papers like to call him.
Wacko
Michael
Jackson.
On the cover of next month's Ebony magazine. It's the first print interview that he has granted in a decade. Now, I should say to you and the audience as well that later on, in a few moments, we'll be talking with Brian Monroe. He did the interview, which marks the 25th anniversary, how time flies, of Jackson's Super Smash album, Thriller. Now, Monroe is vice president and editorial director of Ebony and Jet magazines and the former president of the National Association of Black Journalists. But here's my question to the three of you, starting with you, Aaron. When black journalists conduct these kinds of interviews with a personality such, a controversial one, such as Michael Jackson or O.J. Simpson, do they put themselves in a tough place and why?
Well, of course they do. I think, you know, number one, they're journalists and they have to be, you know, objective, but they're black journalists. And so they may be interviewing that person. They may have the in because they are black. And there's kind of an assumed empathy that on the part of the celebrity being interviewed. I think, above all, you have to be the journalist and you're not anyone's advocate, although you may be more receptive to certain issues with a black subject, you know.
Yeah.
And this is an issue for all of us all the time, not just with, you know, with famous people.
How difficult a straddle is it, Kevin?
Well, I think that we always have to consider the publications. I mean, Ebony has long been known as it would be the kind of place where, you know, there are often a lot of celebrity covers. I know that Brian is trying to get a better mix of serious substantive issues, but it is the kind of place that you could expect an embattled figure, as Michael Jackson has been in his country, to want to go and appear, something he feels a little more comfortable at. I think that we don't have black news magazines. We used to have, say, Emerge. I think that the kind of interview that would be done by Emerge would be a different kind of interview than the one perhaps done by Ebony. And I think that has as much to do with the kind of publications they are as opposed to them being black.
That's an interesting point. Cheryl, if there is criticism of an article about Michael Jackson in a publication like Ebony not perhaps being as hard-hitting as some might want it to be, would you consider that to be fair or perhaps unfair criticism?
Well, you know what kind of publication Ebony is, you know, and for a long time, I mean, it's a place where it appeals to middle class readers. You go for a kind of soft landing, you know. Ebony does kind of puff pieces, you know. It's been doing that for years, and I think you can expect that's what you expect of Ebony. You know, you don't expect a lot of hard hitting questions. I wish they would ask him one or two. But I'm looking forward to reading what he has to say.
It should be interesting. I was thinking about what I would do if I were in a situation like this, interviewing Michael Jackson. And one can only presume, and Aaron, you know about this, that Michael Jackson probably laid so many rules down about what you could and could not ask him before he even agreed to be interviewed.
Of course. Oh, of course. Well, that's the whole thing with celebrity journalism. There's always that, you know, the ground rules that you have to agree to before you even get an interview with someone. You know, that's first and foremost. But, you know, I just want to say one thing about blacks and journalism. I mean, we have a tradition of advocacy journalism, meaning whether you're in the black press or not, there's this assumption that, you know, you are primarily there to support, to accentuate the positive. I think that's increasingly problematic, even for a celebrity piece. I think we as journalists need to ask hard questions of ourselves, and ourselves meaning, you know, Michael Jackson and whoever else we're talking to. Not necessarily to, you know, we kind of tend to fall into the positive, negative sort of paradigm, and that's really not that helpful.
It's a situation that seems to be, do you think, last thing to you, getting tougher for us?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you feel that way, Kevin?
Well, I think that, you know, we're getting much more diverse within the media. We have a lot of people doing a lot of different kind of journalism, and I think that's important. I think what Aaron says is it's not so much about being positive or negative, but about bringing our experiences to this craft and often, you know, painting some complex portraits of us when we do these stories.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there because we have run out of time. I want to thank Aaron, Kevin, and Cheryl, not Cheryl McClain, but Cheryl McCarthy, who was a columnist for Newsday, joining us from our bureau in New York City, Kevin Merida, an associate editor at The Washington Post, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, a contributing editor at The LA Times, here in studio with me at NPR West. Thank you again, everybody.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.